Hey guys, this is Mike Mahaffey, the old bastard BJJ guy, here for BJJ Metal Models. Back in my day, we had to walk uphill in the snow both ways to get to the academy just to learn some crappy technique from a random purple belt. You kids have it so easy, because now you can just subscribe to BJJ Metal Models Premium and get tons of great audio courses to learn new techniques, enhance your mindset, and entertain yourself. You can even get personalized rolling reviews from some of your favorite BJJ Metal Models coaches, including me. It's like having your own seminar, you spoiled little whippersnappers. So what are you waiting for? Subscribe to BJJ Metal Models Premium right now, get off my lawn, and go train.
Hey, welcome to BJJ Mental Models, episode 175. I'm Steve Kwan. BJJ Mental Models is your guide to a conceptual and intelligent jiu-jitsu approach. And today, from the other side of the pond, we got Mr. Daniel Strauss. Dan, how are you doing?
I'm doing very well, thank you. Thank you very much for having me.
I guess I gotta ask, as a guy who's got a pretty sweet alias, where does the name Raspberry Ape come from? I mean, not only are you named after an animal, you're also named after a flavor. And that's pretty cool, if you ask me.
Yeah, this is the first question that I usually get asked on most podcasts. So we don't take away, you know, we don't eat too much into the main sort of the main stuff we're going to be talking about today. I won't give you the long version. I'll give you the short version. But basically, I wanted a name that was ambiguous enough that I could make up an elaborate story whenever I was asked it. And this is kind of I've always been big into, I do love apes of all kind. Of course, you know, the funny thing that people don't consider that humans are indeed apes as well. So you never know which one you're talking about. And I also really love raspberries. So it kind of just came together and it was super unique. No one else had that name. And also I could make up some ridiculous stories, which throughout the many years that people have asked me, if I have the time and I have the effort and I want to take the piss a little bit, then I'll tell them some crazy stories. So there's a lot of people out there who have, and somehow some of my crazy stories have made it onto, you know, some people have thought that they were real and thought that they were true and started giving facts about me during some of my matches that are completely made up. So.
It's funny. It reminds me of, I think the best slash worst origin story I've ever heard for a nickname before was for Minotauro Nogueira. There was an interview a long time ago he did in Pride back when he was kind of relatively newer on the scene. And they were asking him, where did you get this nickname Minotauro from? What a cool nickname. And his explanation was, well, I was at the gym one day and one of my training partners said, you need a nickname. How about Minotauro? So we went with it. It's like, that is the worst origin story for I've ever heard.
And the best thing about that is that it's a terrible origin story for a very, very cool and iconic name as well. That's the best thing about
it. Yes, it's a legendary name with literally the dumbest name. Origin story. Well, with that said, though, I mean, we've explained where the name comes from, but of course, you're also a well-known fellow podcaster. Of course, that's how you came onto my radar, probably a lot of other people's radars. Go ahead and give your thing a plug.
Yeah. I have the Raspberry Ape podcast. So if you remember the nickname, you remember the podcast name. And I talk to a variety of different guests, very often within the jiu-jitsu and MMA world. But I try and talk a little bit to some interesting people that I find outside of that as well. And yeah, I record all of my episodes in person. So it's a little bit more difficult for me to get a huge number. And I've just got to be kind of lucky when I'm grabbing people, especially people from America or outside of the UK, when they travel over here or when I manage to get out of the country and bring my recording and stuff with me. But yeah, I think we're coming up to 100 episodes. So I've been doing it for a little while and there's some really good ones in there.
Big milestone. Awesome. And of course, the other thing I know you for is your proclivity for picking up gigantic things and throwing them in your garage.
Yep.
Listeners, if you are not following Mr. Daniel's Instagram, highly recommended. If you've ever wanted to see a giant Englishman pick up rocks and bags of sand while he's wearing like Daisy Dukes and then throw them. Highly recommended follow.
That's a pretty accurate representation of my Instagram, I'd say. But yeah, I mean, when we first spoke about doing this, I was thinking that if I had to talk about one subject, it would probably be grip training and, you know, maybe we'd do that another time. But, you know, like you said, since your listeners apparently wanted me to talk about guillotines more than Marcelo Garcia, which I think will be something that I'll have framed and put on my wall or something.
On your tombstone, it'll be, right?
Yeah, absolutely, yeah.
Yeah. So the backstory here for listeners is I wanted to have Daniel on the podcast for a while, and the most obvious thing to talk to you about, Daniel, is grip strength or just general strength training. But I recently put a poll forth to our listeners because I was looking for a guest to do a technical deep dive into the guillotine choke with. And Mr. Daniel Strauss here was the number one requested person to discuss this with, beating out Marcelo Garcia, which is quite
pretty,
an honor.
Pretty ridiculous, yeah. Especially since I consider him my personal BJJ and specifically guillotine hero. So
same here. My whole guillotine game is based off of Marcelo.
I mean, pretty much everyone who does jiu-jitsu, he is the man. And when it comes to guillotines, he certainly is.
Well, guillotines are one of my favorite submissions because they're amazing for a few reasons. One reason is because there is really no weight limit, strength limit, size limit to where a guillotine ceases to be effective. In pretty much any situation, you're going to be able to use a guillotine choke and have success. You can be fighting someone who's 100 pounds bigger than you, and a guillotine is going to do just as much damage to them as if they were the same size. Other benefit to guillotine chokes that's probably worth mentioning is they're awesome as what I suppose you could call a flash submission. There's a lot of submissions that only work if you go through big, elaborate setups to get there. Guillotines do have those big, elaborate setups. But the other thing about guillotines is, much like certain types of leg locks, you can just snap them on out of the blue if you're really good at them. And they can be just a fight ender that comes out of nowhere. So a guy with a really good guillotine is always going to be dangerous no matter the situation. And so for that reason alone, I generally recommend that pretty much everyone who trains jiu-jitsu needs to get good at the guillotine. And I wouldn't say that about all techniques. I mean, there's a lot of submissions. For example, if you're a smaller person and you're not having success with triangles, I think it's reasonable to say that, okay, well, maybe you don't need to use those. Maybe there's other moves that would be a better fit for you. But guillotines are almost universally applicable. So with that said, Daniel, I'll give the floor to you here. Tell me a little bit about guillotines. Let's chat a little bit about what you like about them and how you apply them.
Yeah, sure. Well, I think you've done a pretty good introduction there. I do agree with you with a lot of what you're saying. You know, I think that they're one of the most, not only the most powerful submissions in the game, but one of the most versatile submissions in the game. I guess one of my main things when it comes to talking about guillotines or front headlock, is I don't view it purely as a submission. And I think that this is something that's really important. There are certain submissions that you can class more purely as a submission. You know, I kind of see it as a spectrum. On one side, you have the guillotine and you have the Kimura. These are two things that you would consider a submission, but actually have a very, very powerful control positions with submission options. And then you have stuff really on the far opposite side of that spectrum, stuff that like an Americana, maybe, and then kind of as we go towards the center, you're getting more arm bars, rear naked chokes. These are things that certainly can be chained to each other and there's versatility in them. But as a control position, they pale in comparison to the amount of control that you have when you have a Kimura and a guillotine. So these are two of my favorite submissions. Well, I don't view purely as submissions, but I view as control positions with submission options. And the guillotine, I think, is for me, the number one when it comes to this. When you control someone's head, and that's what you're having when you're in a guillotine position, either with one hand or two hands. And that's another thing, you know, when I teach guillotines, I also like to teach being able to control with just one hand as well, because sometimes you're not, you know, sometimes you want a free hand to be able to do other stuff. Sometimes you want to be able to threaten more than one thing at a time. But being able to control that head means that you can, there are many, many transition options that you have, takedowns, back takes, guard passes, sweeps, you know, so many different things that you can do with it. And then you have the option to submit from there as well. So I think it's an incredibly versatile position with a very powerful submission coming from there.
I love that idea that the guillotine is not just a submission, but it's also a system. And as I get older and more experienced in this sport, I look more for submissions that can be systemized versus just getting the tap. I remember, you know, when I started jiu-jitsu, I would go for guillotines. And of course, as soon as you try to wrap your hand around someone's neck, They'll immediately get their hands in to defend, and it's even harder in the gi to finish because just due to the friction, it's hard to slip your hand through. You got to really have a clean entryway yeah. to get under the chin in the gi if you want to get a guillotine. So I remember originally I used to get a little bit frustrated because I just couldn't secure the tap as much as I wanted. But over the years, I've learned how powerful the guillotine is just as a whole system in and of itself. You don't have to use it to get the submission out of the gate. You can use it as a threat to advance position and to play into other things, much like you said you would do with the Kimura trap, where the threat of the guillotine forces a predictable response out of your opponent. Because if you're going to threaten a guillotine, I mean, I don't care if you're fighting Brock Lesnar. If you're threatening a guillotine on someone, they have to bring their hands in to defend that choke. So I use the guillotine a lot, for example, to secure a guard pass. If I'm in half guard on someone, I'll try to guillotine them from there. And because their hands are busy, it makes it way easier for me to get the pass. It's a very powerful position for advancing and even from takedowns as well. If you can do a snap headlock or something on someone who's standing, as soon as you start threatening their head, it basically kills their ability to play the stand-up game. So it's just such a powerful attack because your opponent must respect the guillotine and they must bring their hands in to defend it.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, it's a really important point. You know, when I teach my students, a lot of them, I don't teach anywhere regularly, but I ran a no-gi program out of a gym in North London for about, I was teaching there for 12 years, but I run this no-gi program, a full-time program for about 4.5 years up until 2019. And my students there, obviously, we'd spent a long time looking at submissions from the guillotine and all of the other transitions from there. And a lot of them would expect me to, if they wanted, you know, I was watching them roll and they wanted to impress me, they wanted to look good. They expected me to want to see them finish that guillotine submission. They wanted, you know, they thought that I wanted to see them get the tap. But actually what I was more impressed with and what I wanted to see more from my students, because it showed a level of grappling IQ and maturity and understanding of the technique, is when they had the guillotine position and they had an option to submit and they weren't able to get that. And instead of continuing to try and get that, they actually decided to switch to a guard pass or a back take or a sweep instead of going for the actual finish, because it allowed me to see that they knew more than simply grabbing onto the head and going for the tap. It can sometimes be very easy to do that, but then when you're unable to get that submission, you just continue trying to, you know, worse, you know, there's always various levels to anything. So the worst level, if you have a guillotine and you're trying to get the submission, you're unable to submit from there, you know, the worst thing that you can do is continue to try and finish when you know that it's not going to be an option. This is going to equal your arms burning out, you losing energy, wasting time, and getting absolutely nothing in compensation for all of the energy that you've put out. So that's the worst case scenario. The sort of neutral scenario is that you feel like you're not going to be able to get the submission, so you release the submission. This goes to show that you're smart enough to understand that you don't have the tap, but also not smart enough to know that you still have a great control position that you can do something from. And then, of course, you have the best case scenario, which is you're unable to get the submission. You realize you're unable to get that. You're smart enough to realize you don't have the tap, but you also smart enough to realize that you still have a great control position that you can transition from. So really, that is the thing that I'm most impressed with. Obviously, I love to see my guys go for a guillotine and get the tap, but I'm even happier to watch my guys go for a guillotine, not get the tap, and instead turn it into something else, because it really shows a great grappling and guillotine IQ.
Yeah, I know Danaher has talked about this idea of people getting myopic when they're hunting submissions or a technique. They, as soon as you get your hand around the person's head, it feels like game over, right? It feels like you should have it. And so for a less experienced grappler, their instinct might be to just reef on that head as much as they can to the detriment of everything else they're doing. But that's the thing with the guillotine, right? Just because you've got your arm around their head doesn't mean you have the submission. There's more to it than that. So you have to have some degree of nuance to your guillotine game where you understand, all right, I'm not yet in the situation where I can finish here. But that doesn't necessarily mean you want to release it, like you said. It's a common mistake where people will have a great grip. They'll have their arm around their opponent's head, but they just can't finish the choke, so they'll give up and they'll let that go. And in my opinion, that's a big mistake. If you're able to get your arm wrapped around your opponent's head, man, if I get that, I want to keep that and use that all the way to pass, to go right to Neon Belly, to go to mount. Getting your arm wrapped around your opponent's head is such a powerful mechanical advantage that in my mind, you should always be hunting that. And even if you don't have the choke out of the gate, you should still use that as a transition and use that to then follow up to get to better positions, better positions, better positions. And eventually, I mean, if you get to the point where you're mounted on your opponent and you still have that guillotine grip, very hard for them at that point to defend and escape.
Yeah, absolutely. When you're attacking a guillotine, or where you're attacking anything, I think people have a really bad habit of when they attempt to do something, anything less than what they're going for, they consider a loss. And it's a very immature way of looking at transitions and an immature way of looking at the progressive movements and flows of grappling. So say, for example, you are trying to go for a submission. Let's say, you know, we'll use the example that we're talking about here. Let's say you're trying to go for a guillotine. And for a second, you think, wow, I'm going to be able to, like you said, you get your hand wrapped around the neck and you think, I'm going to be able to finish this match. And then you end up, there's a scramble and you end up instead getting the sweep and you end on top in side control. You are underneath in butterfly guard. You took the guillotine and you managed to get on top of the side control and you lose the guillotine. Now, if you at that point think, man, I've really lost out here. I've lost the submission. I've lost the match ending or round ending finish there. Well, then actually you've completely missed the bigger picture. Jiu-jitsu should always be, grappling should always be a constant forward momentum where you don't have to jump five stages ahead in the journey to a super dominant position and eventually a submission. You don't have to jump from guard into mount, from guard to back, from guard into a submission, into a triangle. You can work your way up incrementally. So I think any forward movement, any advancing of a position should be seen as a benefit. So you need to take a step back and go, well, look, you started underneath guard and you finished on top of side control, or you've started in half guard and you finished in mount, or you started in mount and you finished on the back. Even though for a second you may have had glimpses of a more dominant position, or you had glimpses of a possible submission attempt, you've still been able to advance your position there. So look at where you started, look at where you end up, and then value what you've done based on those variables instead of the possibility of what you might have had, if that makes sense.
Yeah, it absolutely makes sense. And that's a great example. Even if you fail to get the guillotine, if you had that guillotine grip and you were able to use that grip to secure a guard pass and then go to mount, I mean, that's nothing to complain about, right?
Absolutely.
You're up like 7 points at that point. That's a great deal, even if you didn't get the submission.
Yeah. And something that you were talking about earlier, which kind of pertains to this point as well. When it comes to your, even though you shouldn't become super precious over a potential to get a submission, your opponent is going to view the threat of submission much, much higher than the threat of any transition. So this is something true, again, of all grappling. There are many principles, as you know, you run a podcast basically based on principles around jiu-jitsu, but something, a principle that's going to work for one thing is very often going to be universal to many other aspects of grappling. And one of the principles is increasing the threat level to allow one of the lower level threats to be passed through without much resistance. So for example, you're looking to pass someone's guard. If you're looking to look past someone's guard and that's the only thing that's happening, well then they are going to be fighting with 100% resistance to stop you from passing the guard. It's the only thing they're having to block in that moment. As soon as you threaten an even higher a level threat, now that could be a mount take, that could be a back take, that could be a submission. But as soon as you threaten a higher level threat, they will prioritize that higher level threat and they will move their resources, sometimes not 100%, but sometimes they will move 100% of their attention and resources to defend the higher level threat, allowing you the lower level threat. So for example, again, we talk about the guillotine, you're in half guard, you're trying to pass the guard, you're doing nothing else but trying to pass and they're blocking that 100%. Then you bring your shoulder over the top and you manage to get your hands around the neck for a guillotine. Your opponent immediately prioritizes the submission as the much, much higher threat. He defends the submission. You manage the pass in the meantime because he's no longer defending the pass. He thinks that he's done great because he hasn't been submitted. But of course, you've won this exchange because now you've passed the side control.
Yep, absolutely. And as a smaller guy, I'm always looking for ways to fight giants. And I find that this is one of the most reliable ways to do it because it doesn't matter how big and strong your opponent is. If you are able to lock up around their head, you can threaten in such a way that they must respond. And usually that means you're going to take one or probably both of their arms out of the equation, right? It's hard to grab a bigger guy and control both of their arms. But if I grab your neck and I force you to defend that choke attempt with both of your hands, now suddenly you're fighting at a disadvantage because your hands have to be occupied. The instant you let your hands go and try to do something else, I'm going to secure the choke. So that is just such a powerful strategy, using the guillotine as a setup for other things. Even like I said earlier, from standing, sometimes I do this. If my opponent takes a lower base and they drop their level down, I'll just try to latch onto their head. Even if I don't think there's any chance I'll get the guillotine, just by threatening it, it kills their stand-up game completely. It also sets up a lot of other nice takedowns like sumigaishi and other things you can do from there. So just a really good strategy across the board. When you can grab onto your opponent's head, you probably should. It works from turtle, from standing, from a lot of positions where your opponent is on the bottom. So one of the things I love about the guillotine is just how good it is as a system so that you can use that to transition up the chain to better positions.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, and as you said, as a smaller person, there are a lot of submissions that may not feel like they're as effective as a smaller person going against a bigger person. But you know, the guillotine is very similar, especially as an arm. I specifically almost exclusively utilize an arm out guillotine. Mm-hmm. I consider an arm in variation to be a completely different technique, which even though I know many people who are super, super effective with that, I've been told by some very, very high level grapplers that I will not name that the arm out guillotines don't work and arm in guillotines are the only ones that work. They tend to be grapplers with much longer arms than myself and other people who are big into arm out guillotines. But I really like the arm out guillotine, and in the arm out guillotine is very similar to sort of the quintessential small guy beats the big guy submission, which is of course the rear naked choke. Because when you can lock your arms around someone's neck with nothing else in the way, you're going to be able to put a lot of force into the most vulnerable area of a human's body, and you're very, very likely to get the submission there regardless of how big they are.
Yeah, there are some moves that absolutely favor people with longer limbs, and usually when you see a move that works better for longer, lankier people, it's moves that attack two things at once. So an arm triangle, for example, or a triangle choke, or an arm in guillotine, where you're not just grabbing the head, but you're attacking a head and an arm at the same time. I find that usually when you're attacking two levers at the same time like that, you're attacking two things, you've got to have pretty good length in your limbs, and you've got to have a pretty good squeeze, because the pressure that you're putting is distributed now against two targets on your opponent's body. Whereas if you coil your whole body around just their neck, doesn't matter if you've got short arms, doesn't matter if you're not the strongest, you're still going to do a lot of damage. So I always look at it this way, where it kind of depends on your body type and your attributes. If you're lankier or you're bigger or stronger, a lot of the time arm in submissions are more effective because you have the power to compensate for the lack of power that you would get from just centralizing on one target. Mm. But you also, of course, if you attack two things at once, you often get a lot more control, right? If you have someone in an arm triangle, for example, it's extraordinarily hard to escape a position like that where you've got two of the person's levers locked up and they can't move at all, even if it might technically be harder to finish. But that said, though, I mean, if you're a bigger person and you've got the strength, a lot of bigger people I know, they love arm in maneuvers like arm triangles, triangle chokes, and of course the arm in guillotine. But I'm with you on this. As a smaller person, I prefer the arm out variation, because if I'm only attacking the person's neck, I can put all of my power behind that, and that makes it way more likely I'm going to get the tap. Whereas if I attack an arm and the neck at the same time, I technically might have a little bit more control over their body, but I just find it very, very hard to get the power to submit.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's really what I have always favored, what I've always liked in the arm out guillotine, which is the ability to get that nasty forearm underneath the neck, you know, really driving a lot of pressure up into the throat and being able to get the tap very fast. That's always been the goal, is to get the submission as quick as possible. With a joint lock, at least correctly apply joint lock, the submission should be pretty much instantaneous. The longer you are inside of a submission and whilst it's being applied, the longer it takes for that submission to be fully locked off and for it to, you know, to start the application of it to the time where your opponent taps. The longer that period is, the longer your opponent has to try and do something to escape. So whenever you're doing a choke, obviously with joint locks are going to be always done. One of the big concepts that I talk about when I'm teaching guillotines is the difference between the two different types of submissions in jiu-jitsu, which is, of course, joint locks and chokes. These are two completely fundamentally biomechanically different things, which we class almost the same because they both make the opponent tap out. And of course, if they don't tap out, completely different things happen. And I think one of the big mistakes that you have when it comes to choking mechanics, especially the beginners make, is they misplace the way that they finish the submission to the wrong type of submission. So for example, what I mean by this is a joint lock is binary. It's either on or it's off. There's no in between. You know, if you're doing an armbar on someone, if the arm isn't fully extended, there is no pressure and there is no chance the person's going to submit, right? So it's on or it's off. There is no in between. With a choke, it can be a little bit on. It can be a lot on. It could be a little bit on and the person goes to sleep because it's been on for 20 seconds. It could be really, really perfectly on, but the person doesn't tap or go to sleep because it's only been on for 3 seconds. So whereas with joint locks are binary, on or off, chokes are a lot more variable. There's a lot more nuance to the application of them. Now, the mistake that many people do is they go for joint lock, what you would call a joint lock philosophy, mentality of controlling the position until you get to the final submission, and then you apply with 100% effort and expect an immediate tap. That is how you should apply a joint lock, but it is not how you should apply a choke. And this is where you see so many beginners try to finish rear naked chokes, try the finish triangles, try the finish guillotines, try and finish head and arm chokes, all different chokes, because they wait, they work, they get into position, and then they apply with 100% force. And if the person doesn't submit within 2 seconds, they readjust their arms thinking that something must be wrong because they're expecting an immediate tap, and then they'll squeeze again. And of course, if their position was correct in the first place and they've readjusted, they've given the opponent time to breathe, to control, they realize that the person doesn't really know what they're doing, and you find that they end up losing the position very, very often. So it's very important to understand, firstly, I kind of went off on a tangent there, but it's a really important concept that you don't hear a lot of people talk about, or I haven't heard a lot of people talk about anyway, which is the fundamental mechanical differences between the two types of submissions, which is joint locks, on or off, binary, and chokes, which are a lot more variable and have a lot more nuance to their, you know, a lot more patience has to be used in the application of the finishes. But that's, you know, with that in mind, the way that I like to finish the guillotine is trying to get the position so good and so powerful and so sharp on the neck that it comes on instantly as if it was a choke, even if you don't apply it as if it was a choke, if that makes sense.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. And that's a really, really interesting point, something I never thought of, but you're right.
Yeah.
If I get you in an arm bar and it's maybe at 50 to 60% power, there's no way that you're going to tap. I could hold you in that arm bar for 10 minutes. And if you didn't tap in the first 10 seconds, you're certainly not going to tap in the, you know, the next 10 minutes. It just isn't going to happen.
Exactly.
Whereas with the choke, it's like everyone has like an energy bar dictated by how much oxygen they can get to their brain. And if you hold someone in a choke that is only 50 to 60% effective, if you hold them there long enough, eventually the choke is going to do its job, even if you don't increase the intensity. So it is a common mistake that sometimes people, they think they've got the choke, they burn their arms out trying to get the choke in the first 5 seconds, and if they don't have immediate success, they just give up. That's not what you want to do with a choke. Maybe with a joint lock, but with a choke, it's more about holding it like a position and gradually trying to drain their energy down. Like you said, sometimes you do get that flash submission where you just snatch it in. It's perfect. The guy taps right away, but you can't guarantee that. Against a good person, they're going to have more defenses up, and it's unlikely you're just going to lock on the perfect choke out of the gate. So a little bit of patience is a good strategy.
Yeah, but not only that. Firstly, when it comes to, you're absolutely right there, but forget about 50% on a choke. You know, one of the ways that I demonstrate this idea, this principle, is I'll take someone, I'll put them into a rear naked choke just because it's the most, you know, easiest to see what's going on. I'll put them into a one-handed rear naked choke position, and I will apply with about 5% effort. And I truly mean that, 5%, and I'm not going to increase it at all. And it's different for different people, but you give them 10 seconds, 15, 20, 25 seconds, those people very slowly, the tap comes because they, you know, the world starts to close in around them. So a submission will come on, even if it is barely on at all, if you give it enough time. So it's all about finding that balance between the two. In terms of finishing, you know, and then I kind of, after going on and talking about all of that, I kind of almost sounds like I contradict myself by saying, but I like my guillotines to come on super quickly. That doesn't mean that I'm applying them with 100% force and expecting an immediate tap. I'm still applying them, even though I want the tap to come within 3 seconds, 2 seconds, 1 second, even though I want the tap to be immediate, I still have the energy reserves and I'm applying it in a way where if I had to and I didn't get the tap immediately, I would continue to be able to increase my output for about 15, 20 seconds, which is an eternity inside of a choke. If you're not tapping someone within 20 seconds and you're trying to, then you're definitely in the wrong position. But that all comes down to making sure that the blade, metaphorically and literally with the blade of the forearm, is as sharp as possible and in the correct position, and everything that you're doing, weakening your opponent's defenses, their resistance to the choke, and then applying in the correct angle, in the correct direction. If everything is on correctly, what I always say when it comes to all submissions, but especially with chokes, if you're doing it correctly, it should be effortless because the technique should be sharp enough itself.
Yeah, absolutely. I totally agree. Another common mistake that I see, and I'd be curious to get your thoughts on this, is that when people set up the guillotine choke, a lot of the time, they will just abandon whatever position they had and pull guard. So I'll see this a lot, for example, where someone, if they're on their feet and the other person is, maybe they're ducking a bit low, if they snatch that headlock, before they've even got the choke set up, they're immediately in guard. They've fallen back into guard because that's how they understand the choke should be finished. Also, I see people who will be setting up a guillotine from half guard or side control, and they'll think they have it, and they fall back, and they let the other person come up on top. And I don't like to finish like that. If I get the guillotine, my preference is to finish with myself on top. It's just a way stronger position. I don't see any reason to fall back. I would rather not do that if I can. So my preferred way to finish the guillotine is I'm on top of my opponent. Either I'm in their half guard or I'm mounted on top of them. I don't want to fall over to my back and let the other person come up into my guard and try to finish from there. I'd love to get your thoughts on that and if you agree with that or if you have a different way of looking at things.
Yeah, sure. It's an interesting point and it is an important point. I think it's important to differentiate when you say, because you're absolutely right. When you say, just before I answer you, I want to clarify kind of what your theory is on this. When you say into guard, what guard are you talking about specifically?
I see a lot of people go right to closed guard. That seems to be the most common thing. I get this in my reviews a lot where someone will snatch on and then they'll just fall back into closed guard. And I generally advise against that.
Yes, you're absolutely correct. This is something that I talk about a lot. So one of my main principles when it comes to finishing the guillotine is that I want to reduce my opponent's resistance to being choked. Now, if you grab someone by the neck and you can, whether you do this to someone who trains jiu-jitsu or someone who doesn't train jiu-jitsu, a random person on the street, which I don't advise that you do, but if you were to grab anyone by the neck, they would all instinctively do the same thing, which is what you would call turtle in the neck. They would try and bring their head closer down towards their body, shrug their shoulders up. They're looking to make their neck shorter, thicker, fatter, and stronger, more resilient and more resistant to being choked. So if that's what someone's going to do to make their neck harder to choke, then you want to be doing the opposite. You want to be stretching someone's neck out. You want to be turning them not from a turtle, you want to be turning them into a giraffe instead. And a lot of the time, this is going to express itself as you physically stretching out their body. Now, the closed guard is a fantastic position. In fact, it is the best position in all of grappling when you are on your back to keeping your opponent close to you, which also, by its very nature, makes it one of the absolute, if not the worst position, for pushing your opponent away. So when you have that guillotine and you sit back into the closed guard, what your opponent is trying to do is your opponent is trying to smother you with their entire body to make their neck shorter, thicker, fatter, stronger, and less able to be choked. And because you're in closed guard, you have nothing between you and your opponent, so you can't generate any space. And now you're going to have to find way more power to try and go through this strong position. And then you start adding in the shoulder pressure and all of the other things that your opponent can do to try and defend against it. So So you're absolutely right. I think using the close guard, assuming that you didn't use the close guard to set it up, but and even in that scenario, it's not always the best. There's other things that you have to do, basically. If you can't stretch him out, you've got to find that space. So, you know, without going too much into detail, I very rarely ever look to get a guillotine from close guard. But if I was to be in close guard and manage to set it up from there, and I couldn't find the space to get my legs out and switch to an open guard position, then what I do, instead of trying to push my opponent away from me, I try and stretch my opponent's neck out, not by pushing them backwards, but by creating rotation. So you're still able to expose the neck, but to the side instead of pushing them away. So the close guard position is a really bad position for stretching that neck out, and therefore you're really going to struggle to reduce the resistance to the choke. So I do like finishing the guillotine from my back, but I instead use a shin across the stomach position. Yes. I never know, you know, I don't know, you might know what this position is called. You know the one I'm talking about, the same side shin your arm is choking with is going to be across the stomach, and then the other leg is going to be over the back. You know, it's a classic position. Do you know the name of it?
I don't know what the name of it is, but to me, I always look at that as kind of going hand in hand with the Marcellotine, yes. Especially. That's where I learned this. For yes. Listeners who aren't familiar with what we're talking about, basically, this looks really weird and counterintuitive because you're actually releasing the guard in a lot of ways, and you're going almost to kind of like a butterfly. But like Daniel said, you've got one of your shins across the person's stomach and the other leg either goes across their back, or you put your foot on their hip and you kick them away or do something. But it looks almost like you're giving the person side control, and you actually kind of are giving them side control. But you're doing it in a way, because of the way that their neck is tied up, you're forcing them into side control, which contorts their neck and makes it super tight from a choking perspective, and also super hard to get out of because their body is in a very weird, awkward position. But it's like one of the only situations in jiu-jitsu where pulling side control on your opponent is actually a good idea. But that's basically what it kind of looks like what you're doing.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. And so I just wanted to check if you knew the name. So I never knew the name of this position, but I use it so much. And I can't think, like you said, can't think of any other reason why you'd want to use this half full guard, half knee shield position. So I just call it guillotine guard. Okay. So anyone else can freely use that. But until I find a better name for it, that's what I call it, is guillotine. In fact, someone called it, after I started referring it to it in all my seminars, as guillotine guard, someone called it neon stomach guard, which I found hilarious. But actually, it's actually
inverted neon belly guard.
It is completely accurate. But yeah, what you're essentially doing is, when you're in a guillotine, especially an arm out guillotine, there is an extreme asymmetry in what your opponent can do and how your opponent can defend. So they are basically going to have one side that is going to be the side that they want to pass to, which is going to make it very, very difficult. And if you don't know the right counters to it, going to make it impossible for you to finish the guillotine. One side is going to be great for them and terrible for you, and one side is going to be great for you and terrible for them. So what you're essentially doing is you're taking away, with the closed guard, you have a barrier to both directions. Your opponent cannot move their left and your opponent cannot move to their right. What you're doing is you're taking away the barrier on the side that you would like them to go to, and you're trading that for a frame to be able to push them away, to stretch them out, and to be able to reduce their resistance to the choke. Of course, on the other side, that barrier still needs to be in place because you need to stop them from moving around to the side. So your opponent has the option of passing to side control, which only increases the angle of the forearm and elbow against the neck, which is going to be really, really bad for them. They don't want to do that. So people will almost never pass the side control, even though it looks like on paper, if you didn't have the guillotine, the person would pass the side control and you basically wouldn't be able to do anything. But with the guillotine, your opponent is not even going to try to do that because the guillotine is going to come on even faster. So you find yourself in this position and you're able to push them away, stop them from moving in the direction that they want to go, and you're able to reduce the resistance to the choke and make it even easier for the finish. So we go back to the point that you were talking about before about pulling guard. There are some scenarios where either you're in guard to begin with. So let's say you set it up from butterfly guard. Butterfly guard is a position where you're using both legs to try and frame and push your opponent away, meaning that it's going to be very easy for your opponent to pass to the side that they want to pass to. So in a butterfly guard, you're going to want to switch. Once you get that front headlock, once you get that guillotine control, you're going to want to switch into this guillotine guard to stop your opponent from being able to move where they want to move. But other positions, yeah. If you have a guillotine and you are on top in side control, absolutely don't fall fall backwards onto your back, try and maintain the power in that position. There's a lot of advantages to having the guillotine in a top position like mount, like side control. But, you know, you're going to have to judge this on a very individual basis, depending on how the position's looking and what your opponent's doing to defend.
Now, something else that I think is worth unpacking, you talked about how when you put a guillotine on someone, the instinctive reaction that everyone's going to have is they try to turtle their head. And that makes sense, right? Because the guillotine works if you can get under the person's chin. If you don't get under their chin, there's no guillotine. So a lot of people will try to do that. And of course, when you are the person doing the choking, a lot of what you're trying to do is negotiate the blade of your wrist under their throat. And that's usually the demarcation line between whether you're going to get this choke or not, is if you're able to get the blade of your wrist underneath the person's neck and against their throat. Now, another mistake that I see a lot of beginners make, though, is they get overly enthusiastic about trying to separate the person's head. So they'll get their hand around the person's neck, and then they'll just use their arms to just try to pull back as hard as they can. And that's not really always the most effective choking mechanic if you want to finish. A lot of beginners, they think that the guillotine is about, I use my arms to grab your head and pull it. But there's actually more than that. What you're actually trying to do is use your whole body, and you're trying to curl and coil up your whole body to actually force your opponent's head to bend down. It's not just about pulling it back and away, but you're actually trying to collapse their head and break their posture down. And you're trying to get their chin to dig deeper against their own sternum. So it's not just about using your arms to pull back and out. It's about using your whole body to coil and to curl your opponent's head so that you try to pinch their chin against their own sternum. That's an important mechanic that I always make sure to advise people on. And it's funny, if you go back and you look at the early days of the UFC, you see a lot of people doing the guillotines wrong, where you'll see these like giant jack dudes who will just grab someone's head and literally just try to pull it off of their body. But a real finesse guillotine is about more than just upper body strength.
Yeah, absolutely. So a couple of things to unpack there. The first one that you said, getting the forearm underneath the neck. Obviously, this is a super important thing. What you basically need, the two important components of what you need to have control of the guillotine, is the wrist underneath the neck, or the forearm underneath the neck, and the shoulder over the back of the head or over the back of the neck. The best way to assure that you do that is, I always teach that the first point of contact that you make when you attack the guillotine should be the wrist underneath the neck, because nothing else matters if you don't have the wrist underneath the neck. If it's in front of the face, if it's under the mouth, in front of the jaw, anywhere else but underneath the neck, then you basically don't have the position at all. So I'm always looking to fire that wrist on the inside. And, you know, especially when you're doing snap downs and stuff like this, I teach, when people do snap downs, they'll snap down the head into position. And then once it's in position, they'll fire the wrist into the neck. Of course, by the time you've snapped that head down, your opponents realize that they're vulnerable to be attacked, and they're going to be tucking that chin, maybe bringing their hands up to defend the entry underneath the neck in the first place. So I always teach that actually you want that wrist coming underneath the neck as the first point of contact, the first thing that happens when you set up that guillotine. That wrist should be coming underneath the neck, because otherwise, you know, you may get everything else in position, but without it, you just don't have it. The second thing about the finishing mechanics, yeah, certainly there's it's almost cliche in MMA to try and finish the guillotine in a wrong way. The way that a lot of people do it is, and it looks very impressive, this principle that I've been talking about a lot recently when I've been teaching is how I've noticed how dramatic submissions usually mean that they're not very effective. And the goal, if you understand what I'm saying, it's yes, something that I haven't thought about, you know, in the many years that I've been training, but thinking about it recently, and I'm like, man, I'm really onto something here. But when a submission attempt and a submission finish is very dramatic, it's usually because it's not working. So when you see a rear naked choke that's lost in ages, and it's like, oh my God, how's this guy not gone out? Or when you see an Americana attempt, or an armbar attempt, or a Kimura attempt, where there's loads of movement in the shoulder or loads of extension in the elbow, these are always occasions where the submission comes either very late or very often doesn't come at all. And this is true of the guillotine as well. When you see, there's almost this cliche image, I've seen it so many times, this cliche image in MMA of the person usually inside closed guard, usually they've been taken down into a front headlock, into a guillotine position, they're in closed guard, they're extending backwards to try and finish the guillotine like they're trying to do an armbar on the opponent's body. And you know, these guys are all jacked jacked. They're probably juiced up at the local MMA show. They've cut weight. You know, the biceps are bulging.
You can see the veins bulging out of their arms.
Yeah, the veins are bulging out. You get a brilliant picture from behind of them trying to finish this guillotine. But then, of course, the opponent escapes and they don't manage to get it. And yeah, this is the image that when I do my guillotine seminars, this is the thing that we're looking to avoid. If you do the guillotine correctly, it should be effortless to be able to do. Like I always say, one of my favorite proverbs is, you give me 6 hours to chop down a tree, I'm going to spend the first four sharpening the axe. And I think that's so true of this, of jiu-jitsu in general, and especially for me, the guillotine, because you need to make sure that the technique is sharp, and you invest in making sure the setup, making sure everything that you do is as sharp as possible, because when you've got it down perfectly and it's all razor sharp, well, then actually the finish is going to be super easy. Interesting you said, in terms of the application of the finish, where you're trying to actually break and create a lot of flexion in the opponent's neck, I don't focus that much on flexion in the opponent's neck. A lot of people who do guillotines, they do that. I focus more on a direct down and up pressure through the line of the neck. The way that I view the guillotine is its namesake. So if you imagine a French Revolution style physical executioner's guillotine, where you have that blade coming straight, chopping down through the neck, that is how I'm visualizing my choke. So I actually purposely don't, or at least it sometimes happens, it very often happens just as a byproduct of what you're doing with your body, but I'm not focusing normally as a cue on looking to get that chin coming down to the sternum, even though a lot of people do. And I'll quickly break down why I do that and why I prefer to teach that way, especially the people who are not super high level grapplers. I know a lot of really high level guys, what often people do is the shoulder position is quite high on the top of the opponent's head, and you're using the head as a fulcrum, and the shoulder comes down and bends the person's head, like you said, bringing that chin towards the sternum as the forearm goes in up into the neck. So there's a lot of rotational torque using the head as a fulcrum with that forearm coming up and the shoulder coming down. Now, what I find with a lot of people is that the biggest issue that they have with the guillotines in the first place is the opponent's head popping out. This is the number one defense. Sometimes people won't even refer to it as a defense because it's so simple, so easy, so common, and happens so early, where you go for a guillotine, you think you've got it, and that head just pops out the top. And this is because people are focusing too much of what's going on underneath the neck. They're focusing too much on that forearm going up into the neck and not focusing about the position of the shoulder. We go back, like I just said, to that physical French Revolution guillotine. You have two main components. You have the blade and you have the shackle, and everyone's focusing on the blade and nobody's focusing on the shackle. But if the shackle isn't locked in properly, that blade is going to drop and the person's going to be gone long before it ever falls. So you've got to keep that shackle locked in. And that shackle, in this case, in grappling, is going to be the shoulder. So I always keep a very, very high towards the base of the neck shoulder position to make it impossible for the opponent to pull their head out, or much, much harder to pull the head out. Now, as you go backwards, and so basically the shoulder keeps that high position, so I'm not really focusing on getting that rotational torque. I'm not using the head as a fulcrum, even though it's a very powerful torquing position. Especially at lower levels, the chance of that head popping out as you try to finish it is a lot higher. It's almost, you've got to grit your teeth for a couple of seconds, because as you try and pull your head out, it's going to hurt worse, but that head can sometimes pop out, and I'm always looking to avoid that. Goes back to what I said earlier, my priority is not the submission, my priority is the control of the position. Therefore, if you can't get the finish, but you still have that shoulder in place on the back of the neck, well, then the opponent's not escaped yet, and you can use it to sweep or pass or take down or do whatever else you want to do. So I focus more on keeping that shoulder very, very deep on the opponent's neck and focusing on that wrist and forearm and that high elbow position to lift my wrist and have that blade go up through the neck to get that decapitation.
Yeah. And a piece of advice I received a long time ago, which was super helpful, was if you're going for a guillotine, you don't want to be able to see their neck. If you can see their neck, that means that you're not in tight enough. It means that you're probably trying to pull back too much, and you're not getting enough of that up-down pressure that you talked about. Yes. So when you see a good guillotine, a guillotine that's likely to work, you should not be able to see the victim's neck at all. It should be completely buried in the armpit. Whereas if you see someone who is reefing back as hard as they can and you can see the other person's neck, that's usually a good indication that they're not going to get the tap, because it's just not effective mechanics. It reminds me of similar advice I heard with the triangle choke, which is, If you want a triangle choke to work properly, you should not be able to see the victim's shoulder. Because if you can see their shoulder, that means that your triangle is not actually choking their carotid. It's choking their armpit and their shoulder, which is not effective. So when you do a triangle properly and you turn your body to an angle, it's going to sneak that shoulder out of position so that your opponent, their shoulder is now kind of trapped and you can't even see it. It should be buried inside the triangle. And that is how you know that you've got the right mechanics. And so similar with the guillotine, if a guillotine is effective, you should not be able to see the victim's neck at all. It should be completely buried in your armpit.
Yeah, absolutely. And especially during your setup and your initial control period, obviously, whenever any transition that's made, whenever you, if you pass guard, I refer to this as the acute phase of a transition. This is any time that you do anything, take someone down, pass someone's guard, sweep someone, take their back, lock up an armbar, lock up a triangle, lock up a guillotine, anything. The acute phase, that's the initial couple of seconds, that's going to be the time that your opponent is most likely to be able to escape. So the longer that they are inside the position, the chance of escaping decreases. So you have to prioritize and really lock everything down as fast as possible during that acute phase, because that is the highest probability, that is the greatest chance that your opponent is going to escape. Once you've got them for a couple of seconds, 2, 3, 4 seconds, so we're going to depend on what the transitions are, what particular positions are, but once you've passed that acute phase, that initial period, well, now you're settling in and you're going to have much better control. So that's absolutely true when you're doing a guillotine as well, which is that shoulder needs to be forward. The range of motion that I talk about is that this is the main thing that I talk about, because I actually, like I said, when I teach a guillotine seminar, what I want people to do is I want them to have the control and of course the option to submit, but my priority is having the control. If you don't have the control in the first place, then you have no option to submit. So the control is always the basis. It's always the fundamentals. So the range of motion that I teach that's so important when you're doing this is a range of motion in the shoulder called protraction. It's bringing the shoulder forward. And it was so difficult. A lot of people really struggle with this. And then thankfully, Conor McGregor knocked out or badly wounded on his way to knocking out Donald Cerrone with these shoulder barges. Of course, those shoulder barges are you moving that shoulder in that protraction range of motion. So if you imagine that you're Conor McGregor trying to knock someone out by bringing your shoulder forward in front of your body, that's the position that you need to be holding in order to keep your shoulder in a good position. So I used to tell people, pretend that you're Conor McGregor. Of course, this was a few years ago when being Conor McGregor was a little bit more of a valued thing. I don't tell people to be like Conor McGregor anymore, but it's still the correct imagery to think about if they're struggling with the range of motion. But yeah, absolutely, especially early on, as you go backwards and you sit and you try and finish the submission, then you're naturally going to lose a little bit of that positioning over the back of the neck. But the less that you lose and the better it is to begin with, then the greater chance that you have of getting the submission and the greater the chance that you have of maintaining the position as well.
Got it. Another question here. Do you think that the guillotine is an effective chain into any other submissions? You know, the beauty of the triangle armbar omoplata combo is how you can transition between one to the other. And so there's a multi-threat attack. Do you have any submissions or other strategies or tactics that you like to chain into the guillotine to go into and out of in case you're not having any success with the choke?
Yeah, that's a great question. And it's actually one of the biggest differences between the arm in and arm out variations. The arm in variation, very similar to a triangle with the legs, because you have control of the arm as well, it gives you many options in your ability to train to chain through different things. So really the two main differences between an arm in and arm out guillotine is one, the finishing mechanics, and two, your options if you're unable to get the initial tap. So with an arm in guillotine, your ability to go to anacondas or to brabo chokes because your arm is still on the inside is really, really high. So you can chain to other submissions really, really nicely. The arm out guillotine, you're unable to do that quite in the same way because you only have control of the neck from a front position. So you're very limited in the options that you have. Now there's different hand positions and there's different grips and there's different directions that you can generate that forearm or wrist into the neck. So there are, I have a variation of the guillotine I call the thrust variation, which is when you're unable to get the drive on the choking arm with your assisting arm by going up with your elbow high. So instead you drop your elbow 180 degrees and you drive upwards. John Jones did a very similar version against Lyoto Machida.
Yep.
And so it's not really a different submission. So really when it comes to the guillotine, arm out guillotine, your options to switch to different submissions are quite limited, but your options to switch to different positions is much greater. So especially something like attacking the back, for example, if you imagine that you're in a front headlock, you're in an arm out guillotine, your opponent is going to be below you. If you're on your knees or standing or moving around, your opponent's going to be below you and your chest is going to be on their back, just like you would be if you were wanting to take the back. So using that front headlock, that guillotine position to move around and take the back is very, very high percentage, very effective, and very valuable on the mats as well. Have I set up submissions from the guillotine? Yeah, I think I have a guillotine into triangle in competition a few years back, but it's not something that's super reliable and it requires a level of flexibility. You know, one of the reasons why armbar, triangle, armbar plata, all of these things chain together so perfectly is because they all rely on having the basic body parts in the right place. So your legs are around someone and you have the head and the arm, and then you're just maneuvering into different positions with the legs. When you have the front headlock, because so many submissions come with the legs, when you have that front headlock and no control of any arms, you're really going to struggle to maneuver into different options and chaining for different submissions. So can you chain different transitions, different controls? Yes. In terms of chaining different submissions with an arm out guillotine, it's a lot more limited than with most other subs, or lots of other subs anyway.
Yeah, I think that kind of ties into why, as I mentioned earlier, I don't like to attack the arm out guillotine from closed guard, because if you don't get it, you don't have a lot of places to go. It is a little...
Yes, 100%.
Yeah, if you're on the bottom with just their neck, it's hard to transition and move. When you're on top, it's kind of a different story, because if you're in bottom side control and I've got a guillotine headlock on you, I mean, I'm happy to just sit there with your head in my armpit for the whole day if I have to. But if I'm on the bottom and I'm not getting the submission, it's kind of hard to really do anything from there. So that is one of the considerations.
If you're in a closed guard, yeah, absolutely. Because you have nothing between you and your opponent. In a butterfly guard, in a guillotine guard, in open guard positions, much, much easier. Half guard, not so great, unless you can maneuver one of those feet on the inside for a half butterfly. But from a guillotine guard or a butterfly guard, many, many options to sweep and do other stuff. But from a closed guard, you're absolutely right. Bad position to finish, bad position to transition, bad position to do anything if you can't get the sub.
Yeah, awesome. Well, one last question I have for you on this topic.
Yeah.
For all of the listeners out there, if there is one thing that they could adopt right now to supercharge their guillotine, one little tip, what would you suggest they do?
Okay.
You can go beyond one if you got a whole bunch.
So what I'll do, and we've kind of spoken about them a little bit, is I'll talk about those two components of the guillotine, which is the blade and the shackle. If you get those two things right, then most of the other things will fall into place, so they won't matter so much. So I've already, you know, obviously it is exceedingly difficult, as I'm finding out right now, but I kind of relish the challenge. It's exceedingly difficult to try and teach technical jiu-jitsu via audio only, but I am up for the challenge. So I've already spoken about that forward shoulder position, that protraction of the shoulder, the Conor McGregor shoulder coming forward, unfortunately to bring him up yet again, but making sure that shoulder is forward and it's trying to cover as much of the back of the neck as possible, and keeping that protraction, that range of motion, always forward the entire time. That is assuring that you are in the strongest position to maintain that shackle, that control. And then on the blade side, it is all about getting the correct position of the wrist on the neck. You don't want to be too deep. You want, you know, that pressure is force over surface area. So the bigger the surface area, the less power is going to be going into the choke. So you want the smallest surface area as possible. It's going to be about, you know, if you look at the line of your wrist, you want sort of an inch and a half up from there is going to be the midpoint that you want right on the front of your opponent's windpipe. And then the big thing with this is actually the orientation of the wrist. This is a massive mistake that so many people make. And the way that I talk about it when I do my seminars is that I say, you know, imagine that you take a super, super sharp knife and you slice into your leg in the exact way that you would try and slice into your leg if you wanted to cut it off. It is going to cut your leg off. Now, if you take that same razor sharp knife and you turn it 90 degrees to the side and then slap it against your leg, what's it going to do? It's going to do absolutely nothing. This is exactly the same as the angle of your wrist into the opponent's neck. So in order for a blade to cut, it must be facing what it wants to cut. Exactly. There can be no movement. There can be no disorientation of the angle of the blade directly at what it wants to cut. So the mistake that so many people make, and sometimes, and this is the craziest thing, most people, when they make a mistake, the mistake comes from the beginning. This is a unique scenario where you'll see many, many people set it up correctly and manage to mess it up on the route to the finish position, which is they'll bring that wrist up to the neck with the exact perfect angle with that sharp blade pushing into the neck. And then as they go to connect their hands, because they give equal emphasis to both hands, as their hands are connected, you see a 90 degree rotation of the wrist. Now you have the widest, flattest, least sharp, least painful, least, you know, cutting angle of the wrist going up against the neck. And then you try and choke through, and it's like trying to, you know, cut a steak with the side of the knife. It's just not going to work. So you need to remember, when you're doing the guillotine, that wrist, the choking arm, that is the king. It is not going to move to meet the assistant arm. The assistant arm is going to work its way around the choking arm in order to take the position. So always maintain the correct orientation of the blade of your wrist into the opponent's neck to make sure it's sharp the entire time.
Amazing. Amazing. Well, I think we covered a lot here today, Daniel. Is there anything that you wanted to bring up that we didn't cover and didn't talk about that you think is important enough to discuss?
I mean, it's such a, I do so many, many, many podcasts on other people's podcasts, and usually they go by the same format. And I mean, I reckon I've done, even the last couple of years, over COVID, everyone seems to have started a podcast, and I just have a bad habit of not saying no. I reckon I've done about, I reckon I've done about 50 in the last 2 years, and I'm not exaggerating, and probably over 100 altogether. But this is such a unique podcast where we talk about something so specific. So I've really, really enjoyed talking about it. And really, I could talk about, you know, this specific, the technical side, trying to teach jiu-jitsu over audio. What a challenge. Really enjoying it. So there's loads of stuff that we could talk about, but I think that we've covered quite a bit there. I guess the final thing that I'd like to say is something completely non-technical about the guillotine, and just one of the reasons why I love it so much, not just because of all of the practical reasons that I love it, but actually sort of the historical and cultural reasons that I love it as well. You know, this is a submission that we use today that is still so common in 2022, and martial arts and grappling and fighting in 2022, that has been around, you know, since ancient Greece and ancient Rome. And you can see pictures on pots, and you can see pictures on coins of heroes or just regular wrestlers utilizing that front headlock control. I mean, I have a 2000 year old coin from ancient Greece that depicts Heracles doing a guillotine on the Nemean lion. And I just think it's so cool. There's not very many submissions out there that you can guarantee people were putting other people to sleep with guillotines, or what we today call a guillotine. People were putting people to sleep with that thousands and thousands of years ago. So, you know, as well as it being a super practical technique today, it's also a really interesting sort of historical artifact as well.
It is kind of crazy when you think about the fact that the guillotine choke actually predates the invention of the guillotine itself by like thousands of years. The choke itself has been around since time immemorial.
Yeah, and you know, of course, that's true of many of the grappling movements that we do, certainly, especially wrestling movements. But I don't know if there's any technique quite as, you know, maybe something like a rear naked choke with the arm, but, you know, choking someone from behind. But there's something deep. The guillotine is so fundamentally human that we seem to have been doing it for as long as human recorded history has been about, and very, very likely for many, many, possibly hundreds of thousands of years beforehand. So interesting.
Yeah. Well, this is an amazing chat. Thank you so much for coming by, Daniel. Before we let you go, plug your stuff. How can people find you?
Sure, absolutely. So having a podcast myself, I'm very, very used to doing the post-podcast plugs. Yes. So if you do want to listen to my own podcast, that is the Raspberry 8 podcast. And you can find that on all the regular channels that you would find podcasts on: Spotify, iTunes, Stitcher, SoundCloud. Many of the more recent episodes for the last couple of years are also on YouTube. My YouTube channel is youtube.com/Raspberry 8. If you want to follow me, the best place to do that is Instagram. My handle is @Raspberry_Ape. And I also have a website, which is raspberryape.com.
amazing. And I'll put those links in the show notes. Thanks again so much for coming by, Daniel. And of course, on our side, if you want to check us out, presumably you know how because you already found the podcast. But failing that, bjjmentalmodels.com is the website where you can reach out to me, contact me, check out all of the historical episodes in the archive, sign up for our newsletter. And of course, we've got a database of all of the major concepts we talk about on the show. And of course, if you want to dig deeper, that's what our premium service is for, premium.bjjmentalmodels.com. And the single best way that you can support the show, as well as go way deeper into some of the ideas that we discuss here. There's a lot of full-length audio series and courses that we have on there with people, frankly, far smarter than myself. We're just in the process of kicking off two new ones with John Thomas and Margot Ciccarelli, so that's going to be super fun. So please do check it out if you haven't already. There's a free trial, so nothing to lose. premium.bjjmentalmodels.com to give it a shot. Daniel, thanks again so much for coming by. Greatly appreciate it. Always awesome to have a fellow podcaster on here because, frankly, so much easier to edit when the other person has the right equipment and they know what they're doing. So thanks again for making the time. I greatly appreciate it.
No, it was an absolute pleasure. I've wanted to be on this for so long. I think that you guys are doing such a great job with this podcast and everything that you're doing. I love it. So keep up the good work and hopefully I can come back on sometime. Thank you very much for having me.
Thanks to you too. And of course, to everyone out there who listens and hangs out with us each week. Thanks to you as well. Talk to you guys next week.